York, this is Democracy Now!
There is widespread falsification of quality data at generic drug manufacturing plants overseas, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is minimizing the findings of its own investigators at those plants. For example, there was one FDA investigator, Peter Baker. Over 5 years, he went into 86 plants in India and China and found fraudulent or deceptive data in 67 of those.
Generic drugs comprise nearly 90% of the pharmaceutical supply in the United States. Nearly 80% of the active ingredients of all drugs, brand or generic, as well as almost all antibiotics, are made outside the United States. How are they inspected? Does the generic version of a drug have the same effect as the brand name? What happens when it doesn't? Just a few of the questions we'll ask investigative reporter Catherine Eban today, author of the explosive book, Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As tensions between the United States and Iran continue to flare, President Trump issued a threatening tweet Sunday, writing, "If Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Never threaten the United States again," Trump tweeted. He did not specify what threat he was referring to. On Saturday, the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, reiterated Iran does not want war and that no country has the, quote, illusion it could confront Iran, according to Iranian state media. Earlier this month, the U.S. deployed a carrier strike group and a bomber task force to the region. And last week, the New York Times reported the Pentagon reportedly drew up a plan to send as many as 120,000 troops to the Middle East if President Trump decides to take military action against Iran. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia echoed a sentiment expressed in recent statements by U.S. officials, saying it does not want war, but is prepared to respond to aggression with, quote, all strength and determination to defend itself and its interests. This follows recent attacks on several Saudi oil assets. It's not clear who attacked the oil tankers. The White House announced Sunday the first phase of its Middle East peace plan will take place next month in Bahrain and is being billed as an economic workshop to encourage financial investment in the occupied Palestinian territories. The, quote, workshop will bring together finance ministers with business leaders from around the world. They'll reportedly avoid addressing any political issues. Palestinian officials said they were not consulted prior to the planning of this so-called workshop and dismissed any attempts to tackle peace talks in the region without addressing human rights and the illegal occupation. This is Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya.
The American administration announced there will be a workshop next month about the economic and investment situation in the region, including Palestine. As a first step of the deal of the century, the cabinet stresses that any solution to the political conflict depends on ending the occupation, achieving the national rights of the Palestinian people, expressed by establishing their independent, sovereign, and viable state on the 1967 borders with Jerusalem as its capital.
Swedish authorities issued a request Monday for the detention in absentia of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is now facing rape charges in Sweden and is currently serving jail time in Britain for skipping bail in 2012. Last week, prosecutors reopened a sexual assault investigation into Assange, which was dropped in 2017 because they said the case could not proceed while Assange was holed up at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he lived for 7 years before being forcefully removed by British police last month. Assange has denied the accusation, and his lawyer representing him in Sweden said he has not been able to get hold of his client to discuss the detention order. Assange must reportedly serve 25 weeks of his British prison sentence before he can be released. Assange now faces possible extradition to both Sweden and the United States, where he is wanted for the publication of leaked documents by Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning, which showed evidence evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq. In related news, WikiLeaks is reporting that Ecuador will allow U.S. prosecutors to go through and take possession of Assange's belongings left in its London embassy. Assange reportedly has two manuscripts at his former living quarters. His lawyers have called it an illegal seizure of property. In Australia, voters and pollsters were left in shock after the Conservative government of Prime Minister Scott Morrison won an election that was largely favored to go to the Labour opposition, which ran on a platform of cutting greenhouse gas emissions and taking on the challenges of climate change. Scott Morrison, who's pro-Trump, has backed major coal mine projects and introduced anti-immigrant policies, most notably turning away asylum seekers to Australia and sending them to migrant camps on remote islands. In Austria, a snap election has been called after the Saturday resignation of Vice Chancellor Heinz Christian Strache, who was also the leader of the far-right Nationalist Freedom Party. He resigned after a hidden camera video was released showing him promising government contracts to a Russian woman who claimed to be the niece of a powerful Russian oligarch. Strache said he or his Freedom Party never received any money and apologized for the incident, blaming his actions on alcohol and his desire to impress his female companion. Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz dissolved his People's Party's coalition with the Freedom Party following the resignation. The news comes as a blow to nationalist politicians in Austria and across Europe who are hoping to increase their political power in the upcoming European Parliament elections taking place later this week. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets in cities across Germany Sunday to protest against the rise of nationalism ahead of the European Parliament elections.
It is alarming how many right-wing parties are active, not only in Germany, but throughout Europe. And history must be learned from. So it's our responsibility to go to the polls and stand against the right and demonstrate.
Meanwhile, in France, as yellow vest demonstrators mark 6 months since the start of the anti-government protest movement, many also called for voters to stand against elite and corporate interests in the upcoming European Union elections.
We believed in Europe. We believed in it completely. But we didn't understand that Europe is very much for the rich, meaning the first thing that it did was to build a huge safety box to stash away their money.
The final phase of voting in India's six-week-long election concluded Sunday. Exit polls show Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party on track to win or retain enough seats to secure parliament. Vote counting will begin on Thursday. Taiwan became the first Asian nation to legalize same-sex marriage Friday. Tens of thousands came out in the capital Taipei to support the bill and broke out in celebration as lawmakers approved the historic legislation. The bill passed 2 years after Taiwan's constitutional court ruled that the legal definition of marriage as being between a man and a woman was unconstitutional, and despite a referendum last year that opposed the move, the new law will go into effect Friday. LGBTQ activists say there remain other discriminatory laws on the books, including adoption restrictions for non-heterosexual couples. Back in the United States, demonstrators gathered in Mobile, Alabama Sunday to call out the state's newly passed law effectively banning abortions, even in cases of rape and incest. This is a protester at Sunday's event.
Making abortions illegal will actually not save lives. There's many young women and women who are going to end up taking their own lives and taking dangerous measures to not have a child. But legalizing abortions make it safe and give women a place to make a choice with their own bodies. And I don't feel like men should have a choice over a woman's body.
There were also protests in other parts of Alabama, including in Birmingham, where presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders also joined the protest. Reproductive rights defenders also turned out to protest in Kansas City, Missouri, after lawmakers passed a bill Friday banning abortions after around 8 weeks, once a fetal heartbeat can be detected, but before many people realize they're pregnant. The bill does not include exceptions for rape or incest. Republican Governor Mike Parson says he'll sign the bill into law. architects of the highly restrictive abortion ban say they welcome legal challenges in the hopes that the cases will end up at the Supreme Court and eventually lead to the reversal of Roe v. Wade. President Trump may be considering Memorial Day pardons for American military members accused or convicted of war crimes. One of the requests is reportedly for Navy SEALs Special Operations Chief Edward Gallagher, who's facing charges of shooting unarmed civilians and killing a captive teenager by stabbing him with a knife while deployed in Iraq. To see our recent interview about Edward Gallagher with New York Times reporter Dave Phillips, go to democracynow.org. The New York Times is also reporting Deutsche Bank ignored employee warnings about President Trump's financial transactions and their recommendations to report them to the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Unit. Anti-money laundering specialists flagged suspicious activity after transactions related to both Donald Trump and Jared Kushner from 2016 and 2017 raised alarm. The New York Times report says Deutsche Bank's decision not to heed those warnings was part of a pattern to protect relationships with high-value clients. Deutsche Bank denies the claims, as did representatives for both the Trump Organization and Kushner's businesses. Previously, the New York Times reported Deutsche Bank loaned over $2 billion to Trump for real estate deals over nearly two decades, even when other banks refused to do so. President Trump sued Deutsche Bank last month in an effort to block them from turning over financial records to congressional committees. Michigan Congressmember Justin Amash broke with the Republican Party, becoming the first Republican lawmaker to publicly say President Trump engaged in impeachable conduct in the wake of last month's Mueller report. In a lengthy tweet thread Saturday, Amash accused Attorney General William Barr of deliberately misrepresenting the special counsel's report. He also wrote, quote, "Partisanship has eroded our system of checks and balances." Trump lashed out at Amash on Twitter, calling him a loser and writing, "Never a fan of Justin Amash, a total lightweight who opposes me and some of our great Republican ideas and policies just for the sake of getting his name out there through controversy." A new investigation by the New York Times exposes the financial schemes at the root of the New York City taxi driver crisis. The report reveals that a group of industry leaders artificially inflated the cost of taxi medallions and orchestrated a predatory lending scheme, collecting millions of dollars in the process and putting many drivers into debilitating debt. City agencies did little to curb the system, which a Harvard professor quoted in the report called modern-day indentured servitude. While the advent of rider apps like Uber and Lyft contributed to a loss of income for licensed taxi drivers, the investigation finds that the taxi medallion bubble had already laid the groundwork for the current driver crisis. At least eight drivers have died by suicide since the start of 2018, with at least some of the drivers linking the decision to their crushing debt. In Atlanta, billionaire investor Robert Smith stunned students at Morehouse College when he announced in his commencement speech Sunday he would pay off the student debt of the entire graduating class.
Let's make sure every class has the same opportunity going forward. Because we are enough to take care of our own community. We are enough to ensure we have all the opportunities of the American dream. And we will show it to each other through our actions and through our words and through our deeds.
Robert F. Smith is the founder of the investment firm Vista Equity Partners. He is the richest black man in America, according to Forbes. One of the graduating seniors at the historically black Morehouse College is Dejon Correa, the nephew of Troy Davis, who was executed by the state of Georgia in 2011, despite major doubts about evidence used to convict him of killing an off-duty police officer. Ben Jealous, former head of the NAACP, who championed Troy Davis's case, tweeted, "Congrats, DeJean. Junior year, high school, grandma died. You mourned and kept studying. Senior year, Uncle Troy was executed despite his innocence. You went back to work wiring jets. That same year, your mom died, cancer. You graduated on time. Today, you're a Morehouse grad, 2019. Celebrate." Experts have warned about the mounting student crisis for years. Nationwide, 44 million people owe nearly $1.5 trillion in student debt. The average debt per student with federal loans is $32,000. Boeing acknowledged for the first time flaws in the software of 737 MAX aircrafts. In a statement released Saturday, the company said flight simulators that were used to train pilots were not able to mimic conditions that were present during the fatal crashes on Indonesia's Lion Air and Ethiopian Airlines that together killed all nearly 350 people on board. And in New York City, activists staged another protest at the Whitney Museum Friday to demand the removal of Warren Kanders, CEO of tear gas manufacturer Safariland, from the museum's board. The demonstration, which took place on the opening of the prestigious biennial exhibition, capped off 9 weeks of actions by a coalition of activist groups who called out Safariland's role in suppressing popular movements, including in Standing Rock, Ferguson, and Palestine, as well as the tear gassing of migrant families at the border. Last month, 48 artists participating in the biennial signed on to a letter demanding Warren's removal from Whitney's board. Some groups at Friday's protests also challenged the role of cultural institutions in the gentrification of New York City. This is activist Betty Yu.
So my name is Betty Yu, and I'm a co-founder of the Chinatown Art Brigade. And the reason why we're here at the Whitney is we're making the clear connection between war profiteers and profiteers of mass displacement. So, namely, the Whitney and the High Line behind me, when they opened up, a lot of galleries here in the meatpacking industry moved to Chinatown. We have 120 galleries gentrifying Chinatown now. And they're being used by these real estate developers, what we call the real estate industrial complex, to pit newcomers and gentrifiers against longtime residents. And what they do is they're the Trojan horses used to raise the real estate value and then eventually will displace Chinatown tenants and residents.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at an explosive new investigation that exposes widespread, unsafe conditions in many Indian and Chinese factories that manufacture generic drugs that comprise nearly 90% of the pharmaceutical drug supply in the United States. Nearly 80% of the active ingredients of all drugs, brand or generic, as well as almost all antibiotics, are made outside of the United States. Generic drugs are, of course, cheaper than brand-name drugs. But in her new book, Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom, journalist Catherine Eban works with two industry whistleblowers to expose how many overseas manufacturers are cutting corners at the cost of quality and safety. This comes as the U.S. Food and Drug Administration just issued its own update on the state of pharmaceutical quality that found the drug quality of factories in India and China scored below the world average. FDA officials say that's because more robust inspections have uncovered problems. Two factories in China and India were linked to recalls of the commonly prescribed blood pressure drugs Losartan and Valsartan after testing revealed the drugs were tainted with possible carcinogens. The report prompted the FDA's Director of Drug Evaluation and Research to conclude, quote, "The quality of the drug supply has never been higher." So can generic drugs be trusted? For more, we spend the hour with Catherine Eban, to discuss this explosive book, Bottle of Lies. She is the author of a previous book on the pharmaceutical industry titled Dangerous Doses, a true story of cops, counterfeiters, and the contamination of America's drug supply. She's a contributor to Fortune magazine, was previously staff writer for The New York Times and New York Observer. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great
Thank
to have you.
You
with us, Catherine.
So nice to be here.
So this is life and death information. Start off by talking about what exactly generic drugs are.
So generic drugs are a version of the brand name drug. They're not an identical copy, but generic companies reverse engineer, they break down the brand name drug and figure out how to remake it. They have to use the same molecule. They have to use the same route of administration, whether it's swallowing a pill, injecting, and then they have to submit an application to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And the FDA reviews data to see whether those drugs are bioequivalent. Do they reach the same peak concentration of drug in the blood? And if the FDA deems that they do, they are approved to make a generic version.
Mm-hmm. And explain what is the breakdown of what Americans take, and also, of course, the insurance industry and what it will cover, which determines what we all imbibe.
Right. So 90% of our drug supply is generic. The majority of those drugs come from overseas. 40% alone of all of our generics are manufactured in India. And if you go to a pharmacy, you will automatically be switched to a generic drug if one is available. What's interesting to me is even though the name of the manufacturer will be on the label, consumers will not have information about where those drugs are manufactured.
Why? Did they ever?
I'm not sure that they ever did, but the companies claim it's proprietary. So for the U.S. consumer, they're getting less information about where their drugs are made than where their cereal is made, where their shirt is manufactured. That information is simply not available, and you have to be, unfortunately, an investigative journalist to figure out where those drugs are manufactured.
I bet a lot of people are shaking their heads right now, and they're going, I knew when I switched to a generic that I felt differently. Now, what about those who would say, what are you just working for the generic drug companies and you are promoting these way more expensive brand drugs?
Right. Well, this is an issue for brand companies and generic alike, because 80% of the ingredients in all our drugs, whether brand or generic, are being manufactured overseas. So this is really a quality issue that is affecting brand and generic companies. And, you know, I should hasten to add, I'm an independent investigative journalist. I have received absolutely no money from any manufacturing concerns, which is a statement that is disclosed in my book.
Mm. So also explain what active ingredients means.
Right.
Again, nearly 80% of all active ingredients mm-hmm. in all drugs, brand
right.
or generic, are made outside the United States. And almost all antibiotics mm-hmm. are made outside the United States.
Right. So active ingredient is the key ingredient in the drug. It is the sort of synthesized molecule that makes the drug effective. It's the central element of the drug that has the effect on the person. So if active ingredient, what's common, an active ingredient will be manufactured in China. It will be shipped to India. An Indian manufacturer will make the finished dose, and then it will arrive at our pharmacy. And, of course, that is invisible to the consumer.
So why did you decide to write Bottle of Lies? What prompted you?
It started in 2008, so a decade ago. And I was contacted by an NPR radio show host, Joe Graydon. He runs a show called The People's Pharmacy. He was concerned because patients were writing into his show, calling in, and saying that they had symptoms, in some cases devastating symptoms, after being switched to certain generics. And those complaints greatly concerned Joe Graydon because there was a lot of commonality between them. A lot of patients were complaining about similar or the same drugs. They were complaining about time-release drugs, so those are slightly more complex. Some of them were suicidal after being switched to antidepressants. Some of them were having seizures after taking epilepsy drugs. And he had been sending these complaints to the FDA, and basically the response he got back was that everything is fine. So he really felt that somebody with, as he told me, and I saved my notes from that call, he wanted somebody with investigative firepower to look into them.
I was just talking to a New York Times reporter last night whose sister has epilepsy, but didn't suffer from seizures for years. She took Dilantin. That's the brand name. But then she had to switch to the generic. It's all the insurance company would cover.
Right.
And she immediately started to seize.
Right.
But she was not allowed to go back on Dilantin. At least the insurance company wouldn't cover it. And he was describing to me about his sister that even when she went into the pharmacy and had her doctor's prescription for Dilantin, the pharmacy would not fill it and would not allow her to actually pay for it.
You know, there's a real disconnect here. If you decide that you don't want to eat factory-farmed meat, you as a consumer can go into a supermarket and buy organic grass-fed meat from a small family farm. But if you decide that you don't want to buy a foreign manufacturer generic or you want to have a brand instead of a generic, a consumer has really no control or power in this equation, which is one of the reasons why this has been sort of so concealed behind layers of insurance companies and middlemen.
Yet the FDA says a generic medicine is the same as a brand name medicine in dosage, safety, and quality.
Right. And on paper, that is true. On paper, that is the FDA's standard. And they will point to that standard. But what I set out to find out, what is actually going on in these distant manufacturing plants where our drugs are made?
We're going to break, and then we're going to come back to this discussion.
Okay.
I mean, you are a clear investigative journalist on the trail. You worked with whistleblowers that are astounding as they go abroad to try to find out what kind of conditions these drugs are made in that are the supply for a large sector of the United States. Catherine Eban is author of Bottle of Lies. The book has just come out, the inside story of the generic drug boom. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with her in a minute. You Can Do, instrumental by Deltron 3030. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're spending the hour with investigative journalist Catherine Eban. She's author of the explosive new book, Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. It's just been published. So take us on a journey with Peter Baker. Tell us who he is.
So Peter Baker was a 32-year-old FDA investigator. They were called consumer safety officers. And in 2012, the FDA looked around and asked, would any of its investigators like to relocate overseas to their poorly staffed remote offices in India or China to investigate the drug plants making our generic drugs. And Peter Baker is a motorcycle-riding, tattooed, tough guy who was up for an adventure. But he had another reason that he wanted to volunteer, which was that by reputation, Indian manufacturers were market leaders in aseptic manufacturing, which is the very demanding manufacturing of making sterile drugs. So he volunteered to relocate and wound up in New Delhi.
And explain what he found.
So he started investigating these plants, and he had a different way of investigating than a lot of FDA investigators. He skipped the guided tours and the opening slideshows, and he went right to the quality control labs.
Wait, wait, wait. Are these tours announced in advance?
That is one of the big problems. The FDA announces its inspections overseas in advance, sometimes giving 2 months advance notice to plants that they are coming.
And so what does that mean? What can they do in that amount of time?
They can do a lot. I mean, as one investigator said, give them a weekend, they can put up a building. But basically, the accusation is that these plants overseas are staging their inspections. And one of the remarkable findings in my book is that they literally have data fabrication teams that come in advance of these inspections, shred documents, fabricate documents, invent quality data, invent standard operating procedures, all in advance of the FDA's arrival.
So he goes into a factory.
Yeah. One of the first plants that he went into was a company called Wockhardt. And this was a sterile manufacturing plant where, you know, the quality controls are incredibly strict, down to employees having to move very deliberately and slowly so as not to disturb the airflow in the plant. It's that strict and regulated. And it was his second day of the inspection. He was in a hallway, and he saw an employee at the other end of this long, brightly lit hallway with a clear garbage bag. And the man was walking in a furtive manner. And as soon as the employee saw Peter Baker and his colleague, a microbiologist, he turned around and started walking the other way again. And the microbiologist yelled, "Stop!" The man broke into a run. He tossed the garbage bag under a stairwell. And Peter Baker opened the garbage bag and found 75 torn batch records, which indicated that insulin the company was manufacturing was contaminated with metallic particles, but nonetheless had been released to patients in India and the Middle East. So Peter Baker's only responsible for U.S. medications, but he followed the trail of these documents. He went to this area of the plant, which had not been disclosed to the FDA, and he found the plant was manufacturing a sterile injectable cardiac drug on the same equipment that had created the metallic particles. So he basically exposed deep fraud in this plant.
And so what happens then? And I kept talking about the number of Americans who take these drugs. But, I mean, these drugs go out to the world.
Absolutely. And actually, as a separate part of my investigation, which is also in the book, the plants make differing levels of quality for different markets. So basically, their manufacturing standard can be whatever they can get away with. In other words, if they're sending to other parts of the world, they lower their quality, they lower their quality ingredients, they skip manufacturing steps.
So what happens when you find this contamination, when an inspector finds this contamination?
Well, in this case, because Peter Baker discovered this, the plant was hit with a massive set of observations in a form called a 483. They were put on import alert, which means their drugs were restricted from coming into the U.S. market. And so in that instance, the inspection system worked as it should.
Can you talk about Rambaxi?
Yeah. So Rambaxi was India's largest drug company and the largest maker of generic drugs and the fastest growing generic drug maker in the U.S. And in 2005, a young information architect named Dinesh Thakkar left Bristol-Myers Squibb and took a job at Rambaxi. So he moved his family to Gurgaon.
To India.
To India. And at a certain moment, his boss, who had also come from the brand pharma sector in England, got concerned about the quality of the data at Rambaxi and had had some evidence that there was fraudulent data in some of the company's HIV drugs. And so he gave Tucker an assignment, which was to investigate all of the company's regulatory filings around the world and get to the bottom of whether there was actually data that existed for all of the claims that the company had made to regulators.
I want to go back to Peter Baker and what happened to him. Mm-hmm. So he exposes this contamination at a major plant in India that's making heart drugs, among others.
In the course of 5 years, he inspected 86 plants in India and China, and he found some aspect of data fraud or deception at 67 of those plants, really almost four-fifths of the plants that he inspected.
And
He found some element of data fraud or data deception in almost four-fifths of the plants that he inspected overseas in India and China. And he did it with a completely different inspection method. Instead of looking at the records that the plant was giving him, he went into the manufacturing plant's computer systems, and he started looking at deleted audit trails. And he tracked the metadata in the computer systems and realized that in many of these plants, they were conducting what are called pretests. They were doing an initial offline screen of the drugs to see what the quality was, and then potentially making alterations to the tests so that when they retested the drugs in the official system of the plant, they would pass quality tests.
And what happened to Peter Baker?
He left the agency in March. Based on the experiences he had in India, he was followed. He was threatened. In one instance, he was poisoned with tainted water at a plant. Some of the investigators that he worked with were spied on. A hotel room was bugged. And based on this sort of aggregate experience, he was actually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress.
And the perks that inspectors get, I mean, what you described is hardly a perk, poisoned water, but what about how they're treated? And how important are these companies to the countries, India and China?
Well, one of the huge problems, as we discussed, is that the inspections by the FDA are announced 2 months in advance. And remarkably, the FDA even turns to these plants to arrange local travel, to arrange hotel ground transportation. And so what happens is that the inspectors arrive. They're picked up at the airport in a luxury car. They're taken to a hotel where their rooms are magically upgraded and they never see a bill. There are trips to the Taj Mahal, shopping trips, massages, golf outings, a system that, as one of my sources called it, regulatory tourism. And the problem is when the FDA says our drug supply has never been safer, they are discounting the fact that the findings of the plants are in this system of pre-announced inspections.
And going back to Rambaxi, this was the largest drug company in India. Explain what happened to it and also talk about Lipitor.
Yeah. So Dinesh Thakur, who became a whistleblower,
worked at Bristol in the United States, Bristol Squibb, and then was recruited to go to India.
That's right. Once he started this research project, which was to investigate the company's worldwide regulatory filings, he discovered that more than 40 products in over 200 countries—excuse me, more than 200 products in over 40 countries were filed with data that did not exist— falsified data in which the company was literally taking the brand drug and running tests off the brand drug and submitting it as its own data? I mean, wild fabrications.
So wait, they would use the brand drug, but in fact, they would put the results to the generic that they were making.
And this is, you know, this kind of fraudulent data is what they were using to get approval from the U.S. FDA. So Dinesh Thakkar, once this got exposed, his boss went into a board meeting and presented this to a subcommittee of the board of directors. And the question that he got back is, could the report be buried and could the laptop that the report was created on be destroyed? So the company chose to conceal this. Ultimately, his boss resigned and he was forced out of the company. And he decided to approach regulators with the information that he had. And ultimately, he became a whistleblower for the FDA.
What happened to the drug company, Ranbaxy?
Well, they not only did they continue manufacturing and selling drugs for more than 8 years from Dinesh Thakkar's first approach, the FDA, in the middle of what was a criminal investigation of this company for fraud, green-lighted Ranbaxy to manufacture the biggest generic drug in U.S. history, the first generic version of Lipitor.
And explain what Lipitor is used for.
So Lipitor is a cholesterol-reducing drug, which millions and millions of Americans take. So it's called a sartan, and it is the biggest selling drug of all time. And 1 year after Ranbaxy was given the green light to manufacture this, they made about $600 million in 6 months. Millions of their doses of Lipitor had to be recalled because they were infused with glass fragments.
And that's just what we know. They happened to find this.
They were under such scrutiny by the FDA that they ended up disclosing the glass fragments to the FDA. Yeah.
And they
had to be recalled.
What can an individual do? I mean, what do you do if you're taking the generic form of Lipitor and you feel sick? You feel different from when you took Lipitor.
So, you know, there is so little disclosure to consumers. I mean, one thing that every consumer can do is they have a maintenance drug. And they feel it's working.
Explain what you mean by maintenance drug.
They have a drug that they take every month, day in and day out, and many Americans do. Let's say they are dispensed a drug that makes them feel good, that seems to be effective, that has minimal side effects.
So you're taking it every day, like for thyroid, for heart, for cholesterol.
Right. What they need to do is look at the manufacturer on the label, okay? They feel pretty good. We are all getting switched from generic to generic to generic every time we go to a pharmacy. But once you know that there is a manufacturer that is working for you, you need to inform your pharmacy that is the drug you want to continue taking. The other thing consumers should do, which I do, when I'm dispensed a drug and there's a manufacturer name, I go to Google and I put in FDA warning letter and the name of that manufacturer in order to see what have the FDA's findings been about that drug and about that manufacturer.
So you have to do the research yourself. Would you take a generic drug? And also, I mean, how it compares to how these brand drugs are made and where they're made in the same places.
Right. Well, I do take generic drugs. Of course, we all take generic drugs because I know the history of a lot of these manufacturers. There are companies whose drugs I don't take and companies whose drugs I will take.
When we come back, we're going to talk about how these drugs are dumped on Africa. I want to talk about the story of Cipla and the significance of this. We're talking to Catherine Eban, who is an investigative journalist. Her book is just out. It's an explosive book. It's called Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. This is Democracy Now! Back with her in a minute.
It's been a while since I could hold my head up high, and it's been a while since I first saw you.
It's Been a While by Stained. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. We're spending the hour with investigative journalist Catherine Eban, author of Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. It's just been published. I want to turn to the Indian scientist Yusuf Hamid, chair of the drug manufacturer Cipla, who shook the conscience of the global health community by offering to produce generic AIDS medication at a tiny fraction of the cost. This is Dr. Hamid speaking several years ago.
You must understand that today in the world, there are about 40 million HIV positive. You must also understand that 8,000 plus are dying every day because of HIV and related illnesses. The problem is not just what Cipla can do. It's a much wider problem. We're a small company. We're not a major company. So I sincerely believe that the effort required is a team effort. The multinational companies, ourselves, the government, our governments of various countries. And it has to be a team effort.
That's Dr. Yusuf Hamid, Indian scientist. We're spending the hour with journalist Catherine Eban, author of Bottle of Lies. Talk about Hamid. Talk about Cipla and what he did.
Yeah. First, let me just correct myself, which is Lipitor, of course, is a statin, not a sartan. We were talking about valsartan earlier, so I misspoke. But Dr. Yusuf Hamid is really one of the great individuals of the 21st century. He looked around, saw this massive AIDS epidemic, and he saw brand companies protecting their drugs through as a minefield of patents, and decided something had to be done. And so what he did was he announced, working with a group of activists, that he was prepared to manufacture AIDS drugs for $1 a day, which was such a dramatic price cut that that set in motion a series of events that led to, ultimately, a very important U.S. program called PEPFAR, in which U.S. taxpayers—
This was George W. Bush program.
It was under George W. Bush. It was President Clinton had a big impact on the events that led to it, because the Clinton Foundation helped, working with Indian manufacturers, to reduce the price further to 38 cents a day. He sort of aggregated the buying power of African governments and U.S. taxpayers, and sort of through this groundbreaking coalition was able to get U.S. taxpayers to buy in bulk AIDS drugs for Africa as a way to tackle the AIDS epidemic.
What was the response of the global pharmaceutical community?
Well, at first, the global pharmaceutical community was actually dead set against this. They were wanted to protect their patents. And the outcry was so enormous that ultimately they waived their patents so that the Indian manufacturers could make these AIDS cocktails at a very low price.
I want to go to a tweet you posted about an executive from the Indian-based company Ranbaxy, the largest pharmaceutical company in India that was. You wrote, "More telling was a shocking disregard for human life from some company executives. When discussing the poor quality of the company's AIDS drugs for Africa on a conference call, a Ranbaxy medical director said, 'Who cares? It's just blacks dying.'"
It's a very disturbing statement, and this was said out loud on a conference call of Ranbaxy executives in about 2004. But it reflected a larger problem in the generic drug industry, which is a lot of these companies have what's called dual-track or multi-tiered production, which is they make their better drugs for more regulated markets like the U.S. and the EU, and they will make worse-quality drugs for developing markets or markets that they call ROW, which is rest of world.
ROW means rest of world.
Correct. Yeah. So those are developing markets where they have made a calculation that because regulation is so poor, they're not going to get caught.
So when someone travels, another example is when someone travels overseas, they say, you can't believe how cheap I can get drugs. Right. They're the very same drugs we get in the United States.
Right. But they're of worse quality. And I shake my head. Even when I was reporting my book and I traveled to India and I had friends say, can you bring me back some antibiotics? And I said, do you understand what I'm reporting? Why would I do that to you?
So you tweeted about your smoking gun around Ranbaxy.
Yeah.
Talk about the documents you found.
Right. So the smoking gun was this PowerPoint presentation, which was shown to a subcommittee of the board of directors. And it spelled out in detail that Ranbaxy had fabricated data, completely invented data for more than 200 products in more than 40 countries in an effort to just support business needs. In other words, they needed approvals and they made up data. Inside the company, this document or presentation came to be known as the SAR, which was short for self-assessment report. And it really shaped the behavior of a number of the company's top executives in an effort to suppress this document.
And again, say what Ranbaxy made and what happened to it.
Yeah. So, I mean, Ranbaxy was manufacturing a huge number of generic drugs for the U.S. market. They were manufacturing generic drugs all over the world. Ultimately, this document, the disclosures around this document and prosecution by the U.S. government, not to mention Dinesh Thakkar's heroic efforts, brought down the company.
Why aren't drugs, the active ingredients, generics, the brand drugs, antibiotics, why aren't they made in the United States for U.S. citizens?
Right. So,
and non-citizens.
This has been part of a sort of long exodus of manufacturing from the U.S. market. It really started with antibiotics. One of the issues was environmental regulations, and companies wanted to very stringent or more stringent environmental regulations in the U.S. And there's a lot of waste production in manufacturing of antibiotics and drugs generally. So they shifted manufacturing overseas to China and to India, and a lot of the manufacturing of other drugs followed. And in fact, the brand name companies also ended up shifting manufacturing overseas. They bought up manufacturing plants and found that, you know, almost overnight, they could cut some of their costs by about 80%, the cost of labor, the cost of ingredients. So that was really one of the reasons behind it.
Could the government produce these drugs?
Absolutely. And Elizabeth Warren, in fact, has a very interesting proposal to get the U.S. government to manufacture essential generic drugs. I mean, looked at one way, this is a national security issue. We need to manufacture our own medicine. What if we pissed off India and they said, sorry, no more antibiotics? We'd really be in a fix.
Hmm. Some of the people you spoke to said they avoid taking prescription drugs.
Well, they were more specific than that. And in fact, this was a number of FDA investigators who, based on the things that they witnessed in these plants overseas, basically have stopped taking generics manufactured overseas.
Where do they get them then?
They try not to get sick. They're very particular about which companies they take drugs from, and it's based on their own knowledge.
Are there lists of records, if you're not an insider FDA inspector, where can you go online to see what companies am I going to get drugs from? And then if you can go more specifically, and even if I'm going to get a drug from a company, I don't want it made at this plant or that plant. Is there any way to find this out?
I have been talking to people about trying to put together forward-facing data for consumers. I don't have any announcements to make right now on that front, but my hope is that there will be some forward-facing data available for consumers. Unfortunately, right now, it's all just
in one bucket over here and one bucket over there. You know, consumers who get really interested in this can look on the FDA's website for warning letters.
What's happened at the FDA? President Trump prides himself on rolling back regulations in the regulatory agencies, the FDA chief among them.
Well, one of the things that's been going on, which really needs further investigation, is that the FDA has been almost systematically downgrading the findings of its own investigators in these overseas generic plants. Now, they just put out a report saying that the quality is very high and everything is fine and they've got this under control. But in fact, behind the scenes, they are downgrading from the most serious findings to less serious findings. And, you know, the documentation that I was able to get shows they're making these decisions for political reasons. They're making them because drafts of warning letters sat on their desks for too long. And this is something that really needs to be, I think, investigated by Congress.
In the wake of your book, public health advocate and whistleblower Dinesh Thakura, as well as Aaron Fox, senior director of Drug Information Support Services, University of Utah Healthcare, have called on Congress and the FDA to hold hearings on generic drug safety. Do you see that happening anytime soon?
I'd like to think that it would. I hope it would. You know, it's very hard to say what, if anything, is going to happen in this political environment.
Have any lawmakers responded? And how much in the pocket are lawmakers, Democrat and Republican, of the drug industry?
Certainly, there is a lot of lobbying. We all know that by the pharmaceutical companies. I think that lawmakers who have been on this a long time are inclined to look at the role of the FDA in all of this and their claims that their regulation is adequate. I think there is some appetite to do that.
So you've been working on this book for years, and you've been doing this kind of research way beyond the research you did for this book. What shocked you most, Catherine?
Some of the falsifications and fabrications that are going on in these plants. For example, they're even fabricating their own data proving that the plants are sterile. They're falsifying their microbiology data. They have to test the environment. They have to test the air. They have to test the water. They're fabricating that data. So what is real and what is fake?
Is there a particular story that sticks in your mind that you cannot shake?
I mean, I would have to say Peter Baker's investigations into the plant Wockhardt, which I chronicle in my book.
Peter Baker, the FDA inspector.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, from the moment that he lands at an airport, is followed by company representatives, one of whom there is a man who yanks open the door of his cab, takes a hard look at him, closes it again. The investigators go to the plant. Several of them fall ill because of tainted water. They learn later that even as they were at night in the hotel room talking about their inspections and their findings, the company had bugged the hotel room. That is the level of the—
And how much support did he get from the FDA?
Minimal. Absolutely minimal. In fact, they pulled him off of doing inspections. I mean, he's one of the most—he's sort of the Pablo Picasso of FDA investigations.
And he left just now, this past March.
That's
under
right.
The Trump FDA.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for being with us. We're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Investigative journalist Catherine Eban is the author of Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom. It's just been published. Her previous book, Dangerous Doses, A True Story of Cops, Counterfeiters, and the Contamination of America's Drug Supply. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Samin Farkandeh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.